Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to violence.
Welcome to Lost in the Static.
Welcome to another Saturday night. I am Josh Hadley. With me, as always, on Lost in the Static is Sarah, not Glenn Criddle, Hanley. I almost said Hadley. Hanley.
I'm neither of those.
Exactly.
Hanley.
And then we also have Glenn, not Sarah Hanley Criddle.
I'm everybody. It's
You're
true.
Every woman.
The cradle of civilization.
Yes. Yes.
Well, if you do want to be, if you want to join what everybody does, you could go to adamandeve.com and use the promo code STATIC, and you would get 10 free gifts along with whatever you order. You would get 6 free DVDs, a free mystery gift, a gift for him, a gift for her, and free U.S. shipping. It's fantastic. You can also go, if you know sex toys aren't your thing, you don't want to use the promo code STATIC at adamandeve.com, go to drivethroughrpg.com and get Al Seeger's Systemless Settings Bundle. If you're a role-playing gamer, different kind of role-playing than the Adam and Eve code gives you, by the way. But if you're an RPG-er, get the Systemless Settings Bundle. You know, you can set your campaign wherever you want. You want a TMNT to be flying a Veritech while shooting down dragons? You can do that. It's pretty cool. So speaking of like D&D and stuff like that, tonight's topic is Glenn's idea. Glenn, why did you want to talk about why revisiting nostalgia might not necessarily be a good thing?
Well, I've been buying a lot of DVDs lately, and as I've talked to you previously about, I picked up a series called Monkey, which is something that I really, really loved from my childhood.
I thought it was Monkey Magic.
It's Monkey or Monkey Magic. It comes by a few names. Monkey Magic is a fantastic series, and it's one of those that I've come back to after many, many years, and I've watched a couple of episodes, and I absolutely love it. But it's one I was also kind of slightly nervous about revisiting, because I've revisited various things in the past, TV series from my childhood, and just been absolutely disappointed to the point of devastation of how bad they actually are when you kind of come back as an adult and see them again.
Sarah, what would be your, I wish this only existed in my memory, so it was some TV show, video game or something that you went back to after many years and wished it was more like what you remembered instead of what it actually was?
X-Files is the first thing that comes to mind.
You shut your mouth!
That was so 90s, and I had remembered it being so much more fleshed out. And it's you watch an episode, and it's the pacing, and it's the camera angles, and it's nothing that they're doing wrong. I think that we've become more accustomed to extra work being put into television shows. I watch that, and maybe you find an old episode of him in the softcore show, and you go, these are kind of shot the same.
Are you talking about Red Shoe Diaries, the Showtime series of chick porn?
Yes. Tell me that you couldn't see an alien just show up in one of those.
I'm sure that they did. I mean, there was a lot of probing happening. So,
see, I never got to see substances. That. Part of me is very happy. Yeah.
Red Shoe Diaries was a Showtime series that it was David Duchovny was a man named Jake Winters who, after his wife commits suicide, you got to remember, this is the early 90s, so he puts personal ads in the newspapers wanting women's stories. So every episode is him and his dog taking a walk down to his post office box, and getting whatever stories, you know, they're of sexual misadventure or betrayal or whatnot. And then he reads them, and then, you know, we see visual reenactments
to the dog
of these. Yeah, he's reads them to his dog. a bulldog, if I'm remembering properly, but I might have that part wrong. I haven't seen these since the 90s. And they're all shot very softcore, it's all about emotional, and there is nudity and all that, but this is very much a female version of porn. And it's always coming from the female point of view. That's why I call Red Shoe Diaries chick porn. And this was what David Duchovny did pre-X-Files. Post-Twin Peaks, pre-X-Files.
I'm kind of glad I didn't see it, actually. It sounds awful.
Hey, this was the 90s. The internet wasn't like we thought it was. It was harder to get porn. This was Showtime, so they could get away with a lot, Glenn. So,
but you had to fill it with saxophones.
Oh, it was so many saxophones.
Oh man, I mean, that's one of the things about going back to that kind of program is the soundtracks sometimes were just so terrible. I mean, I remember an awful lot of saxophones from that time. In music soundtracks to films and TV, and you kind of listen to it now, you go, oh wow, that's just it doesn't fit, it doesn't work anymore. And it's just one of those things, you might have enjoyed it at the time, but now you look back at it and you go, wow, that's just cringe making.
Yeah, and I absolutely agree with that. And I'd say certain things are trapped by their time. And I do mean trapped, as they did not evolve, because like the early 90s, remember the early 1990 TV series She-Wolf of London, which later became the idiotically named Love and Curses for its last six episodes? Did either of you watch that one at all?
No, I didn't catch
that. I caught an episode or two, but it wasn't something I had on TV all the time.
Well, Glenn, it's She-Wolf of London. The first 14 episodes were shot in England, so. But it is quintessential 1990s. And I'm not necessarily saying that in a bad way, but lots of saxophone, the pacing, the way the episodes are edited, the humor, and
fog machine.
Well, it's London. You're going to, you know, and it's on the moors. Yeah, it's going to be fog. But it, you know.
Yeah, but 90s fog was special. It occurred anywhere you needed it.
At least it wasn't that kind of fog that turns you inside out. Stupid cheap weather stripping. But, you know, you do look at these things. Like, my brother is younger than I am. And we grew up watching The Simpsons. We grew up watching The Simpsons from Tracy Ullman's show shorts all the way through the current era. And my brother was obviously younger than I, and so he didn't his memories of the early Simpsons episodes, he was remembering them like he was when we were watching seasons 4, 5, and 6 and whatnot when we were kids. And then he went back and watched season 1, and he called them unwatchable. He's like, the animation is so archaic. The jokes, sometimes they'll go a whole minute without even trying to be funny. And he's like, the voices are all wrong. And I'm like, if you think that's bad, don't dare go get to check out the Tracy Ullman shorts again. If you can't handle Simpsons season 1, stay away from the Tracy Ullman episodes. But
yeah, they were rough.
Right, but at the time, they were fine. I remember, I mean, I've never been a Tracy Ullman fan. Just her humor never has done anything for me. But I watched Tracy Ullman's show religiously every week because of the Simpsons shorts. And then I go back and watch them and I go, you know, I don't think they're bad for 1988 or 1987 and 1988, okay? But they're not that good. They're not that funny anymore. So
I'd say that they could work in the right setting if the Spike and Mike tour was more had more stops to it. You could definitely put it in there, and then the audience would be in the right mood for it. But yeah, that they're a little rougher than people are willing to put up with. I would, but you know, I'm Weird Art Chick, so yay.
Well, now, it's not just that kind of media, though. There's a thing about video games. I know a lot of gamers my age who grew up on the Atari and, you know, the NES and whatnot, and they go back after playing Xbox 360 and all this for so many years, they go back and they look and they go, wow, this is just bad. It's repetitive. The graphics are huge and blocky. Like, I heard one friend of mine said to me, how did we ever enjoy this? And I think that's kind of insulting, isn't it? How did we ever enjoy this? Glenn?
Yeah, it's a shame. Yeah, it's absolutely a shame when you kind of look back at it like that. I mean, obviously, you're kind of trapped to a certain extent with your current point of view. And, you know, I'm a big one for going back and checking out the games of my childhood. And I wasn't really a console guy. I used to, my first computer was a Spectrum 48 and then the Spectrum 128. So I was working with what was essentially like a low budget PC. And, you know, I remember having so much joy and so much excitement, so much fun with all these games that I used to get, and thinking they were absolutely the dog's bollocks and just loving them. And you go back to them, you go, wow, it's just incredibly basic. And some of them, you know, you can revisit and go, yeah, I can see why I liked it, but you are still seeing all the cracks in it now, you know, because everything's so much more, dare I say it, sophisticated in certain ways, at least technologically. Yeah, I've revisited some games and just went, how the hell did I ever play this game? How did I spend so many hours sitting in front of this thing, like Horace Goes Skiing? How did I spend so many hours playing this damn thing? And not only that, you know, waiting 10 minutes for the damn thing to load.
Well, it was a ZX Spectrum, so what do you expect?
Mm. Well, take best put my teeth back in. Take base system. So, you know, you had this screeching of the loading screen and all that kind of stuff going on. That was one thing I was always jealous of with my friends who had the Commodore 64. It was generally silent when it was loading. Spectrum 48, no, it gave you the beautiful Dolby Surround kind of screeching of every bit and byte being loaded into that computer for a good 10 minutes.
But what about you, Sarah? Any video games you revisited that you just went, oh my God?
There have been some of the early Game Boy games, and I hate to say that because it is a beloved little tank of a system that survives things that even human beings can't. There's that one that went through the Gulf War and it's all melted.
It was hit by napalm.
I know.
All they had to do was clean the screen off and it's still loaded up.
Yeah, you look at your Kindle wrong these days and it gets broken.
Yeah, it's having a bad day. It goes, fuck off. But yes. Yeah, this was also during the time when you got, what is it, one game, maybe two if you were lucky, a year. So you are going to play the hell out of that. You are going to enjoy if you got E.T., you would put the time in to actually find a way to beat the first level. I never have, but I have a feeling that, Glenn, you are plucky enough that I give you that as an 8-year-old and you will either slit my throat or beat that game.
The games that I played as a kid were all about the challenges, really, because the Spectrum 48, as much as I loved it, was never really a particularly, shall we say, pretty game system. The games on it, though, I remember being just devilishly hard. You would spend hours and hours and hours. And I've mentioned the game before. It was a game called Jet Set Willy. And it was just a platform game, and you'd have to go around the mansion and pick up all the bits of rubbish after the party before the housekeeper would let you go to bed. Which sounds like a really shit story, but the story was always besides the point. It was the challenge of what was going on. But the first release of it,
it's a game that the title that is a title of its own porn parody. You're set.
Yeah.
Yeah, as soon as you said Jet Set Willy, I'm like, are you sure that's not like Beat 'Em and Eat 'Em and whatnot?
sadly not. But the original release of that particular game, it had a bug in it. If you went into this one room before you'd completed everything else, there was an error that would happen, which would completely stop you completing the rest of the game. So, you know, under most circumstances, it was impossible to complete because nobody knew about this bug. That's the kind of challenge we had, you know, and it made me the man I am.
He's proud of it, damn it.
It's he the shows British his face bug scars. In...
Yeah, it's the British stiff upper lip in the face of adversity.
Well, do you think that this revisiting and not appreciating it at the same, do you think that's because of society in general that we become so spoiled now with all of the different games and everything nowadays? And I don't just mean with games, but I mean society itself moves so much faster. And, you know, it used to be like to get information, you'd have to wait for the morning paper and hope that those reporters would talk about whatever the incident in your town is. Now you get Instagram photos before the police even arrive. That do you think it's as a society we've kind of become spoiled that if – let's say for the sake of argument, video games did not progress past the NES era. Let's say in 2015 we're still Super Mario Brothers, Legend of Zelda-style games. Do you think that younger kids would still look back at those and kind of like, ugh? Or do you think it's just because we as older people have kind of been indoctrinated by – what's new that we can't appreciate what's old anymore? Sarah?
I think that it was said by someone much wiser than me that for each game, there's a certain mindset that you need to be in. There was a ridiculous thing that just came out. I think it was a representative of EA that said, games are too hard and we're sorry. Games are too hard? Now,
have any of you fuckers just... ever played Ghosts and Goblins?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah,
that's a bitch of a game.
You're complaining that someone needs to put a couple of hours in to get the feel of the game. If you don't make a game that's good enough that makes me want to put those couple of hours in, that's where your problem is.
It's kind of like you, back in the day, it was kind of like you got three lives, you know, suck it up and get on with it. And no continues either, bitch.
Well, that also kind of plays into like the difference between, you know, by like 1987, when the Nintendo came out. I mean, yeah, obviously you had console gaming prior to that, but it was arcades were still very, very relevant throughout the mid 90s. Arcade games and console games are so radically different in their style. A console game is there to justify the $60 you spent on it. An arcade game is there to eat your quarters, so it's designed to kill you as quickly and cheaply as possible. I find it funny when modern gamers that are just absolute experts at Gears of War and all that, you put them in front of a fucking Defender machine, or you put them in front of an old arcade game, and you watch them fucking get frustrated as hell at how quickly they die. I do think there's a difference in the eras that they didn't grow up with that. So I do think there is almost a generational thing in the gaming industry with looking back like that. But I also think it goes the same with movies and TV. Like, Sarah, you brought up the X-Files. I recently watched a couple of old X-Files episodes, and they do feel very 90s in their editing and the way they were shot. I disagree with you. I think the stories still hold up quite well, especially the Monster of the Week stories. Don't even get me started on the conspiracy and how ridiculous that got. But the Monsters of the Week story still held up. But I can almost see how maybe an 18-year-old today won't, you know, going back, they watching the X-Files for the first time, won't get into it. I've heard complaints from people that have grown up only with Star Trek, Voyager, and Enterprise. They try and go back and watch classic Star Trek or the first three seasons of Next Generation, And they're like, my God, it's so slow. It's just, I don't know. Is it a generational thing? Do you have to grow up with something to appreciate it? Or can you go back?
I think growing up helps. I think that each era has a different way that they pace stories. That's why, even though we can go back and watch something that holds up from the 90s, it's going to be a lot harder to find something that holds up from the 30s, just because there was a completely different mindset around that. And they're going to set up the camera so that they get more full body shots, so that people have paid for the entire body. They haven't paid for the head, which was the actual thought of the day, which kind of blows my mind. But yeah, there was a thread in there somewhere.
Well, Glenn, what do you think about this? Do you think this is that it's generational, or it's just, if, say, maybe these kids had much cooler parents who they grew up with Star Trek and Star Trek The Next Generation, would they still be like that? Or is it because Voyager and Enterprise, being the worst of Star Trek, but were also much more fast-paced, they didn't waste time just, you know, giving you a quiet character moment. They always got into it. Do you think that it's just, it is how you're raised, or the generation itself can't accept the way things used to be?
I think it's more a case probably of what you're used to. When you're exposed to something like, you come along to something like the Star Trek series, and you're only used to seeing like Voyager or Enterprise, you have certain expectations of how these things should look and how they should feel. And each and every one of those series feels very different for one reason or another. You know, we can make judgments on what's the best, but if that's what you've been first sort of presented with, that's where your expectations sort of come from. And I guess, you know, when it comes back to computer games and things like that, we grew up with that stuff, and it was the new thing. It was the best that was there, the best that was offered to us. And, you know, of course, now things have progressed, things have changed. The new generation is looking at the stuff which is being presented to them, and then they're making their comparisons backwards, which is not an easy thing to expect of someone, to kind of look at something which is, a shall we say, a lot less shiny and a lot less polished, to ask them to immediately or kind of intuitively think that oh yeah, there's value in that. That's something they have to kind of eventually sort of learn for themselves. So I don't really blame it as a generational thing, although, you know, it is partly that. It's not something I think is something that you can heap scorn upon a generation for doing. You can only really do that when they kind of later on refuse to identify where it is the stuff that they loved came from, you know, the history of where of how these things happened. I mean, we look at the stuff that, you know, the films that you look at, the films that I will look at, anyone will look at, which are kind of from before our birth. And it's, you know, at first time you watch them, you don't necessarily appreciate them, you know, when you're first exposed to them. It's kind of a learning process, I think. And I think that's the key to it in many respects, is for a new generation, you've got to give them the time and the reason to go back to those things. Because there is that sort of expectation that, yeah, it's newer, it's better, it's older, it's going to be less sophisticated. It's often just different.
But in a lot of cases, new and improved does not mean better. I can't even count how many products are new and improved, and yet people still prefer the old. Hell, just look at computers. Look at how many people – there was actually a market out there. One of the computer stores near me had a big sign in 2014. We will install Windows 7 on your computer, because nobody wanted Windows 8. Mm-hmm. Newer does not always mean better.
It's funny, though, isn't it? I think we are, to some extent, these days, we have kind of... I don't know, actually. I'm not sure it's that new a thing. There is sometimes a suspicion of the very new. But I think when I look back to kind of the stuff that I liked as a child, I don't remember him particularly being like, oh, my God, this is kind of the absolute cutting edge. It's absolutely brand new. We're going to fuck around with this thing. like with Windows. I think the difference between something like Windows is you get used to this thing that you're kind of been using for 1, 2, 3 years, whatever. And then somebody comes along and goes, right, we're going to take that away from you and you're going to have to learn it all again. So I think there's something kind of different going on.
Also,
in that respect,
you can't leave out the fact that Windows 8 was a piece of shit. Can't leave that out.
I've not really used it. I've got a friend who would disagree.
Let's put it this way, Glenn. I don't know a single person who had Windows 8 that did not tell me at least once, I really got to figure out how to put Windows 7 back on this computer. So, Sarah, your thoughts?
Glenn? I almost just ruined the joke. Windows 8 was their attempt to make Apple users use their program, but Apple users aren't going to do that. They're already happy with something that's not going to be buggy and fall apart. And people who prefer PC already don't use Apple. And for some reason that they've already, you heard what they're going to do. They're going straight from 8 to 10 because they've proven that they can't sell things, they can't make things, and they can't count.
Yeah, they're just skipping Windows 9 straight out because, well, if people hated 8, they're really going to hate 9. Let's just go to 10.
Which goes to the theory that I've heard from so many people who have PCs that only the odd number ones are good. And so I could audibly hear over the internet my friends going, but I wanted a good program.
Pretty much. But I want to look at – let's look at like something with styles from time to time, you know, from era to era. Look at a movie like Alien or a horror movie like Poltergeist. That's actually more relevant. But look at Alien. That movie is paced like a 1979 movie. Just think about Alien. Everyone remembers how violent it is and whatnot and how the sequels were. Almost nothing happens in Alien for the first 45 minutes. And yet you are never bored. You're always engaged. And nowadays, Alien is seen as boring and quaint. You look at the Alien sequels. And they're right out of the gate. It's action, action, action. One of the 20th Century Fox executives was quoted as saying, it was on the Alien Quadrilogy box set, you got to get them within the first 5 minutes or you're not going to get them. And it's like, do you even remember the movie you made in 79 called Alien that was all about building tension and mood? Nowadays, mm-hmm. If Alien were remade, it would be a goddamn jump scare movie. It would be like,
no, don't you put that out into the world. Don't you do that. They're going to make it then.
I'm sure they are. But like now, obviously, we haven't seen the Poltergeist remake. But just judging from the trailer versus the original Poltergeist, the original Poltergeist, it does have some jump scares, but they're all built up. And it's all the original Poltergeist is creepy as shit because of the mood and the tone of it. The new Poltergeist trailer has more jump scares and boo moments in it than the entire 3-film franchise does from the originals. That it's the new Poltergeist is Boo Scare the movie. That do you think an audience that is going to go to Boo Scare the movie, aka Poltergeist, would be able to watch the original PG-rated Poltergeist and actually still be scared of it? Is that also a difference in just Poltergeist was made in the early 80s, Poltergeist Boo Scare is made in the 2015, that they're talking to different eras? Because I believe the original Poltergeist was made for the same audience. Obviously not the same people because of ages, but the new movie is made for high schoolers and teenagers. That's what the original movie was made for. So why such a shocking difference in how the essentially the same film is being made? Sarah?
Really? I saw the original Poltergeist, and I felt that it was like a Stephen King book on screen. I saw it as a high schooler, but I like to think of myself as more intelligent even at that point than the rest of the cattle. So, man, no, I always saw that as for an older age bracket.
That movie, I saw Poltergeist at a very, very young age. And that movie today, maybe it's because I'm remembering being scared originally, or it's because it's genuinely creepy. I still have moments where the hair on my arm stands up during that movie. And it's not because something, boo, at the camera. It's because the mood and tone is so creepy that you put yourself in that situation and you are getting creeped out. I highly doubt this new Sam Rockwell version is going to do that.
No, the original is a perfect 2 a.m. movie.
No, it's not, because then you're not going to sleep
at any point.
Yeah. What about you, Glenn? I mean, do you see what I'm talking about? How these are for the same essential story, the same essential characters, and they're made for the same time-displaced audience. Why are they such radically different movies?
I'm going to be a little glib here, and I'm going to say I blame MTV.
The first film did come out a year before MTV. No, it was MTV was 2 years before Poltergeist, so MTV was around for the first one too.
Yeah, but the thing is, the point I'm trying to make on that is a lot of entertainment has become this, shall we say, version of Blipvert. There's this fast-paced, quick changing pacing which has to happen in films, and it's gotten worse over the years, that you know you've got to keep things happening. There seems to have been this loss of I don't know, will within the writers to slow things down and make things kind of build up like the original Poltergeist. And you know, I think, I'm not sure when the jump scares thing really kind of kicked off. I guess it was 90s, is probably, and late 90s at that. That for some reason, they think that banging pots together is a massively scary thing to do, just because it's a loud noise. And they seem to forget that, you know, if you're not in a cinema, most people don't have the TV turned up to that kind of volume where it's even moderately effective. And for me, whenever I've watched a film like that, and I watched the Paranormal Activity bollocks, which I thought was just a terrible bloody movie, I think it might be in the sequel where you got this shot in the kitchen and they're just hanging around, just milling around, doing stuff. And you're just going, there's going to be a jump scare. There's going to be a jump scare any second now. Bang. Oh, I'm so frightened.
It's so telegraphed.
It is, and they can't even do jump scares properly. The best jump scare, in my opinion, ever was in Jaws, when he goes down to the boat and he starts fiddling around that tooth that's stuck in the side of the sunken boat.
Oh, and the corpse flies.
And the head falls out.
Yeah, it comes right out of the porthole. Actually, no.
It nails me.
The best jump scare ever, and it is so perfectly set up, is John Carpenter's The Thing. I thought you'd say that, Gary. That's why we're doing you last. And then he puts the hot needle in Palmer's blood, and it jumps up, and there's no music. It's totally silent until that and Jesus Christ, if you don't jump through the fucking ceiling, you are nailed down too tight. You are wound too tight. That is a perfectly set up jump scare. Or when Norris's chest opens up and bites Doc's arms off. There's no fucking way you saw that coming.
Well, it's not a jump scare if it's telegraphed.
Yeah, if you're looking for a jump scare, it's not a jump scare.
Telegraphed, yeah.
And that's the, I think that was the thing with Jaws. And yet they had the music. There was a slight build-up in music in it. And you knew something was going to come. And for some reason, it took me years to work out kind of what was going on with that particular scene. And it's building up, it's building up, it's building up. And you know it's coming. I've seen it before. I've seen it like five times before. And it still gets me every time. And I kind of figured the way it was timed to the music, it was almost like a half beat out from the music. And it just comes just at like half a second before you bloody expect it. And it was just absolutely formative in my taste of films, that one moment.
Well,
because it scared me every time.
Well, do you think then, when it comes to especially like horror films, but non-horror films as well, that this, if they're set in a contemporary setting, that they're too trapped into their time? Because like I brought up my brother earlier, my brother, no matter how much he can get into the characters or the story, he laughs at the original Dawn of the Dead because of the afros and the fashions. He cannot take it out of its 1978 time period. Do you think that is a fault of the younger generation? I've heard people, because you know, I've talked endlessly about how groundbreaking Network is as a movie, and people, younger people, look at it, and I get letters from listeners that like, my God, the technology is so funny in this. The hairstyles are so funny, and it's the trappings. They can't get into the stories and characters because a guy's got an afro, and it's not done in a hipster sort of way, so it kind of takes them out of it. Are we just old fogies in that? That, you know, like when I'm watching a movie from the 30s, I can go, that's the way it was in the 30s. That's the way the women dressed. That's the way men wore their hair. It doesn't take me out of it. Are we the weird ones that, like, Network and Dawn of the Dead, we can put in their contextual settings?
I think it's a lack of sophistication sometimes, and I don't mean that to be a criticism of viewers these days, in a kind of like being mean way, at least. It's very difficult for some people to sort of let go of the fact that this film's in black and white, for instance, you know, and sit down and actually get involved in that film, put aside the fact that it's black and white. And you get the same thing with contemporary settings. It's set in the 70s. So therefore you've got this sort of alienation from the story in that kind of respect. And it's a sad thing about the viewers in general when that happens. Again, it's nothing new. If you're a serious movie fan, you learn how to get yourself past that. And same with gamers, you know, serious gamers who are interested in the history of these games and, you know, the stuff that preceded, the stuff that they firsthand experienced, they learn how to kind of put aside those prejudices or those kind of like preconceptions of these things that they're experiencing. So in some ways they're more sophisticated consumers of that particular thing, and I think that's the key to it, really. If it's something that you've been presented with and it's completely alien, it's quite natural to sort of laugh at it, because, you know, partly you don't understand it. And I think it's kind of a self-conscious thing, I think, to be dismissive. And it's a little defensive to be dismissive of those things. But it's down to the failings of the viewer. It's not the failings of the actual thing itself. And I wouldn't necessarily pin that on a specific generation.
Well, speaking of that, Sarah, you're younger than Glenn and I. Did you have any trouble? Because I know you're a big fan of 70s movies and 80s movies and that, and you weren't alive for these. Do you have any trouble divorcing yourself from, say, when you watch a mid 80s movie, going, "Oh my God, the clothes and hair"?
I am an incredibly big fan of Twilight Zone, but before I was introduced to that, I had a problem watching things that were in black and white, and because I was distracted by looking for the color in it. It's not a smart thing. I got over it, but I had to get myself over that, and it is part of the development of the audience. It's like you want an informed electorate, you want an informed audience. You want people to be able to watch something and get the story from it, which means you have to get past the clothes, you have to get past the hair, you have to get into what the character development is. And that does not come quickly, that does not come easily. And I would have to say, Josh, I think that it may not be a horrible thing that these people are writing these letters to, because they are early on in their journey to becoming the type of viewers that you're hoping that they will be. You know, that they're, by them writing to you, that it shows that they have an interest. It shows that they have a curiosity, and that's what you need. That's what people who are going to get new ideas have to have. So I know that it makes you sad. It makes you worried about the audience, about the people who are watching this material or listening to this material, but that they're taking the time to reach out to you. It does say something about them, and it says something about you, and it is more favorable than I think that you've seen it as.
And I don't necessarily think you're wrong, but I see it as sort of a cinematic arrogance that, you know, for a younger person, they grew up on a certain type of movie, and they're not either willing or able to go backwards properly. Whereas, I'm not saying I'm more sophisticated, but I grew up during the 70s, the late 70s, the 80s, and the 90s. So I was watching all the contemporary stuff. At the same time, I was watching, you know, Them and All in the Family episodes and, you know, old Starsky and Hutches and stuff like that. At the same time, I'm watching Miami Vice and you know, modern sitcoms.
And this is what I'm bringing up. You have this experience, and they are growing this experience. If we're to go back to video games, not everything that's from back then is good, and not everything that's from back then is going to hold up. And it does seem to have panned out that things that were trying to be on the cutting edge, look at the sports franchise games that come out every year. You don't play them the next year. Look at how incredibly high-tech the first Tomb Raider was at the time. And
it's a giant blob of pixels.
You can't play that. It's boob triangle pixels. Those are the best kinds, right? But you also have a game like Grim Fandango, which just got a re-release, and they made it a little prettier, but it was stylistically solid. We're talking about the things that were able to take the technology of the time and use it to their advantage. Not trying to push the border, but which is good in its own way, because it's going to get you better games later on. But if you take the material that you have at the time and you make something that has character and it has style and it has depth, and be that a game, be that a TV show, it's something that when the audience is up to the ability to appreciate that, it's going to be there. And I hate to be that person who's like, and that's why this is a wonderful time to live. But
well, okay. Then do you guys think then that that art, and I mean art for the sake of art, is something that is timeless, or should it be made for now, whenever the now is that it's being made for? For example, comic books. You go and pick up a 70s or 80s issue of a Marvel comic or a DC comic, and you'll see artwork that is you go you look at it and you go, that is 1980 late 80s artwork. That's what it looks like. And then for comic books, like in the early 90s, you had that Joe Murata anime influence where all of a sudden everyone's got the big eyes and less ridge detail and whatnot. And you go, that is 90s and whatnot. And then you go, oh, then there's the computer coloring of the late 90s and whatnot. That do you think that these things, which are all being made for right now, but for instance, like movies that reference a current TV show, as if that TV show is always going to be around. Like, go back and watch Basic Instinct, and there are several references to Bart Simpson on there and Bart Simpson merchandise. Now, in this case, The Simpsons is still around, but you look at that, what was that, 90, something like that, or 91 maybe, and you just go, that was kind of risky to put Bart Simpson in there. You've got other movies where, like, they'll reference The Noid. Who the fuck knows The Noid anymore? You know, do you think that using modern day references or Glenn, I'm sure you've seen Nothing But Trouble, right? The Dan Aykroyd Chevy Chase movie that is basically What If Texas Chainsaw Massacre were a sitcom?
I haven't actually, but I'm going to now.
Okay, do you guys remember the Humpty Dance? Do the Humpty Hump?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
That guy is in the movie singing that song. As if Dan Aykroyd, as director of this film, was like, this thing is so timeless, this is never going to become a punchline. So do you think making art for now is what you should aim for, or you should make art to be timeless? Because, like, let's go back to Alien for a moment. Other than the hairstyles, that movie could be made today. There's nothing in that movie that dates it other than some of the women have very late 70s hair. That's about the only thing that dates Alien. And then you have other movies that even made today. You look at movies from 5 years ago, you go, oh my God, that is so 2010. So should you make art to be timeless or just to be when it comes out and you hope it becomes timeless? Glenn?
That's not something I think can be kind of answered in one way or the other kind of response. I don't think making a film for the present is something that should be desperately avoided. I think there's ways that you can avoid unneeded, unnecessary dating, like with the kind of throwaway pop culture references like the Humpty Dance, which, yes, the writers should have looked at that and went, okay, you know, 10 years down the line, who the hell's going to know who this person is, other than some people who are kind of very good at reminiscing about
us.
Pointless pop music. Yes. But, you know, I don't think it's something that should necessarily be a priority to worry about. I think primarily you need to be making a film that's going to work for the audience that you intend it for. It's impossible to kind of look ahead and go, yeah, fine, this will still be absolutely fine in 10 years' time. The example that you gave is actually kind of interesting because sci-fi is one of those things where it can transcend that kind of issue. Like Star Wars, for instance, is another one which doesn't really look dated other than a couple of the haircuts. You know, it's amazing how sci-fi and stuff, because it doesn't have to have the pop culture references. It doesn't have to have the styles and the fashions of the time. That it manages to very often, at least more often than any other genre that I can think of, it manages to avoid that trap of falling into, yeah, this looks 70s, this looks 60s. It's not always the case, of course. I mean, you can kind of look at Flash Gordon and know exactly where the hell it came from.
or even more, blaxploitation.
Yes.
That is 70s.
Yeah, but that's sort of really, really steeped in pop culture at the time anyway, so you kind of expect it to have something like that.
You do. Sarah, as a younger person, what do you think?
Are you saying that the ninja rap dates it somehow? I don't understand.
That was so 1990.
Painfully so.
Yeah.
But Sarah, Sarah, you're younger than us. So that's one of the reasons you're on this show is you have a different perspective. Instead of Glenn and I always talking about you whippersnappers getting off our lawn, you're younger than us. So bring a younger perspective to this.
Yeah, I was. Then get off my lawn. I was going to say not make me. I was going to say also fantasy. You have a movie like Labyrinth, which is incredibly 80s to the point where there's just one scene that I wish that they had done better, and then it would have been all practical effects that would have still held up completely. But I can't see that a person should think about where their movie is going to be in 20 years. For one reason, that's one more piece of pressure that you don't need when you're trying to get 1,000 things to work all at the same time just to get your movie made. But what I would suggest that they focus on is, what is it that you're trying to say with this movie? And can you get this to the audience that's going to appreciate that? And if you can do those two things, and if you have a script that's good enough, and if you have people who are competent enough, then it's going to be a work that will get out there. It even if you have a movie that's forced to sit on the shelf, like Trick or Treat. There's movies that have sat on the shelf and then they've just come out this year and you go, yeah, that was on the shelf for 3 years. I can totally tell. But then you have something like that horror movie that I just mentioned. And even though that had such a hellish backstory just to get out there, can you tell me that you didn't enjoy that?
Well, I think especially when something sits on a shelf, technology can really date something unintentionally. Like I remember there was this an action movie, the title is escaping me at the moment, that I saw right when the DVD transition was coming in. So it was set in the future and they were all using VHS tapes. And I was like, you know, by the time it came out, DVD was becoming the thing and they were all using discs in future movies. So I'm like, you can tell this was made, you know, for the future right before DVD came in. That's unintentional dating. Mm-hmm. You know, they weren't trying to be, hey, we're trying to be current with all these VHSs. It was, that was the technology at the time, and nobody really could have seen that DVD was going to, you know, take over like that. So there is unintentional, where you things beyond your control. You know, Escape from New York. It's a mm-hmm. Glenn, back me up. It's an audio cassette that he unwinds at the end. And this takes mm-hmm. place in the far future. Because there's no possible way John Carpenter could have seen CDs, even though they technically existed at that point, being the format that they would use. That gets unintentional laughs by today's audience. And I don't think it should. Because in 1981, we had no problem with that being an audio cassette.
You can always future bullshit it. Well, you know, that was just really advanced microfiche. Shut up.
Yeah, but you look even at something like Alien as well. In the little computer room that they go into, and you can immediately tell, you know, the era that the film was made in because of the way the computer works. And they're using keyboards, for God's sake. There's no voice commands or nothing like that. It's just kind of tapping away on nothing less than a green screen monitor.
Except in the case of Alien, that what the makers of that new Alien game call it, Alien Isolation, that they call it an interesting lo-fi future. And I don't mm-hmm. think that's necessarily something that's dated, because that whole lo-fi thing has made a huge comeback. That's a topic for a different episode, though. But
no, so, You're quite right. Yeah, you're quite right. The thing is with Alien, the whole kind of set design and the aesthetic of the ship does kind of lend itself to that. It does manage to blend in. But I'm wondering how many people, now would look at it and go, "Crikey, that looks old. That would, why haven't they got color monitors?
Well,
Why
yeah.
isn't he talking to us?"
Have you ever seen, if either of you ever seen Alien Nation, the TV series, the Fox series from like 90, actually, I think it was 1990? It takes place in the
I've
far
seen
flung
some, yeah.
future of the early 2000s, and they're all still using giant block computers and, giant cell phones. And I'm like, I get it. This was made in 1990, so they kind of were stuck, especially on a TV budget, with what they could afford. And, a show like that had a most of their budget went to makeup effects. But it instantly dates it to you go, wow, this was made in 1990. Holy crap, was this made in 1990? So I think sometimes they're trying to be like with Nothing But Trouble. Hey, let's be cool with what the kids are into today. And other times it's, well, this is what we got. Live with it.
Yes.
Well, you
that's
just
when you
got to
have to
deal.
flummox them with your story.
And Alien Nation was a
That's
fantastic show. So there.
Yes.
So, all right. If people want to get a hold of Glenn Kriddle and they want to bitch at him about how he needs to get back to the 80s and, live in the time of the nasties, where would they do so?
You can find me at YouTube as LampyMan101, or you can find me on Geek Juice Media.
Where can we find Sarah, the young pup of the show?
Oh, sorry. Human speak. You can find me on
You have to start spelling
Glenn's
about you.
lovely webs. I would put something down. I'm not sure about my indoor house skills. You can find me on Josh's lovely website and DeviantArt, Anna McKeon. And I have just revived my Tumblr because I'm forcing myself to put out more stuff. So there will be stuffs everywhere. Everywhere
Okay.
stuffs.
And the website she referred to is 1201beyond.com, where you can go and get t-shirts, click on some links. There's some Adam and Eve links to go there. And there's lots of other stuff. And there's Glenn and Sarah. And then there's Radiodrome and all this other stuff. So go to 1201beyond.com, or you can contact the show at 1201beyond@gmail.com. And hit us with a message. Let us know if we are doing the same thing we're complaining about, that if we're making too many current references, that in 5 years, this episode will be incredibly dated and people will laugh at it.
Lost in the Static is a 1201 Beyond production. Visit 1201beyond.com for more great shows.